Blog Talk Radio.
Consuming, eating, deleting, ruining.
trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres, so I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me, sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes like part of me, but I got a real big spirit, a fearless, a fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul, it's like a military soldier, 10-7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Dang. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Sabali. Patience. Yeah.
Pretty Lion. Rebel Sharon Green. Welcome to another edition of the Provision of Government of Republican African Radio. Your co-host, Minister of Information, Bumani Shakir. I will join with my fellow co-host, Minister of Interior, Akin Bekele. Before I bring in our guest tonight, I'd like to read something called The Historical Foundation of the Black Nation, then also following reading a portion from HP's element, then I'm bringing our guest. Okay. The Historical Foundation of the Black Nation of North America. Land, independence, and self-government has been objectively sought by black people ever since we were kidnapped from Africa and brought to the country as slaves. Many ran away and established communities in the woods, mountain swamps, armed themselves, and created bases in which they could operate and to which other slaves might flee. Others organized rebellions, aiming at freeing slaves and liberating territory from which to build an independent state. So the black people were forced to come to this land, black nationalism was not taken lightly. Although brutally crushed, our ancestors continued revolting. Although sold down the river, they continued to escape. Independence and determination was what they wanted. These blacks were, in effect, laying bricks on a foundation which was later to become known as Republic of New Africa. By 1660, the social practice and oppression laws of the emerging Euro-American nation had made it clear that Africans, free or slave, were not to be permitted to join a new white nation. Despite vicious repression, the essence of our African culture survived and bound us strong together as a new African nation that has endured up to this day. In 1865, the 13th Amendment recognized the freedom of black people. On international law, black people had four clear options as to a political future. One, the right to return to Africa as we were the victims of warfare and illegal kidnapping. Two, the right to general immigration as our family were cruelly fragmented and scattered throughout the diaspora. Three, the right to seek admission as citizens into the United States and strive for multiracial democracy. And four, the right to remain in the soil, negotiate with the Native American and establish our nation in and an independent territory, for we find ourselves on soil claimed by the U.S. in great numbers and with several homeland ties. Clear this right to self-determination was available under U.S. law. Because the 13th Amendment simply recognized the freedom of all blacks, it imposed no political condition whatsoever on a newly freed slave, and contain no statement of citizenship in the American community. In varying degrees, each D option were to exercise by various settlers of the black nation. At no time, however, was a national plebiscite, people's vote, held to inform our people of these options so collective that choice could be made. For over 100 years after 1865, the new African nation was kept alive by a succession of dedicated nations led by Henry Adams, whose movement saw independent land anywhere, by Benjamin Pop Saber, Singleton, whose movement went into Kansas, by Edward McKay, whose movement went to Oklahoma, by Marcus Garvey, and Drew Ali, and Elijah Muhammad, by Queen Mother Moore, Malcolm X, and others. Okay. Now, I'm going to read the point from the HP Elements. This is point number 7, called Inherent Military Viability. Because despite all peaceful efforts, certain sources in Mississippi and the United States are certain to attack us militarily. We must always have sufficient inherent military viability, defense capability, to protect ourselves against attack by the Klan and any of the other white civilian armies. This means that the men and women who work in Cushing, in the base, and in the black counties of the other five states must have not only the particular professional skill they are employing, such as teaching carpentry, medicine, they must also be prepared to use military equipment and techniques well. In short, all the cadres in the South must be well-equipped militarily and well-trained. They must be constantly alert to the need to defend themselves and the black community. Military viability is best reinforced when the people who live on the land are, one, prepared to support the cadre in every possible way, and two, are prepared to join actively in defense of themselves in a well-organized manner under leadership of our cadres. And this was fully executed by the RNL 11. You know, and we say this the modern way, it said, go Shalambu, Black Hour Salutations. Black August was a commemoration that was created in 1979 in the California prison system in San Quentin. Upon going to the early 80s, this cadre had accepted the concept of New York Revolution Nationalism and it spread to New African Independent Movement in the early 80s. You know, without ado, I'd like to bring welcome to the show tonight, Mama Tamu and Baba Hakima or the RNL 11. Your lines are open. Free the land, Elder. Free the land.
Yes, free the land.
Free the land, Mama. How you doing? Free the land, Mama. How you doing? How y'all doing?
Doing well. How about you?
Oh, I'm strong. I'm strong. First, I'll let thank y'all for coming to this broadcast. Sure you're not understanding. Thank you for the work and the sacrifice and the influence you share has today. I want to salute y'all for a long, continuous years and decades of strong marriage, built through struggle and pain, and bloodshed, and so forth and so on. I'm grateful for having the sacrifice to push our beautiful children and continue to do the work, even though the situation on their level happened. I want to thank y'all all for that situation. I want to thank you for everything. You know, everything y'all did. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
You know, yes, sir. I would like to. I'll let it ask. Can y'all get like a brief bio of who y'all are for the people who are listening now? People who are listening in the future know exactly who's talking. Tell the people about yourself.
You want to go first, baby? Or
no, you can go first.
Greetings, family. This is Hakima Kenyama, and. Just as a side note, today is my birthday. I'm 79 today, and we just celebrated a little bit ago, and my baby conceived at Parchman Prison Farm was, and her birthday is today as well. That's Shinyeri, and we call her Shay, and so we're celebrating life, and you know the family is doing well. But in terms of background, again, my name is Hakima. Mama Tamu and I became citizens of the government at Cornell University. There was an event there around Black Studies, and Imari made a presentation and hundreds of us became citizens at the same time in that environment. And I think that must have been maybe 69.
Probably.
And Tamu and I both lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And when we came back to Milwaukee, Brother Chokwe soon reached out to us and began to work with us, and we established a consulate, a government center there in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And during our trips from Milwaukee to Detroit to learn more, at one occasion there was an official New African naming ceremony, and Mama Tamu and I both got our names. As a matter of fact, Brother Chokwe gave us both our names, and then you know it just continued from there, building, but I'm originally from North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. Went to school in Durham, North Carolina, and after graduating in 1966, moved to the Chicagoland area, Chicago, Illinois, and East Chicago, Indiana, and then later to Milwaukee, where I connected with Mama Tamu, and you know we've been together since those early days. Mama Tamu, you may want to give a little background now for yourself.
Okay. Well, again, greetings, family. Yeah, I was actually born here in Georgia. My family moved to Wisconsin when I was about 2 years old. Went to school there and everything. Met Akima when I was in college. And I, as they say, cut my revolutionary teeth with the Republic of New Africa. It was the first time that I had really heard about people wanting self-determination and independence and all that. It was new to me, and it really hit me, and I just bit into it with everything I had. And like Akima said, you know, we then got our names in Detroit by Brother Chokwe. Traveled back and forth to Mississippi and to other events. Became a citizen at Cornell. Akima and I, of course, after the arrest in Mississippi, which, you know, I guess we'll get into that a little later, but after I came home and made my visits back and forth and had the conjugal visits, you know, we were able to have our three daughters, all three of them conceived at Parkview Penitentiary. And Akima came home. Our youngest daughter was a year old, and so we, you know, had our family, and we continued on. And I've taught school for over 30 years, always teaching from an Afrocentric point of view, bringing in as much culture as I could in the environment that I found myself in. But it was pretty okay back then. It would be really hard nowadays, but it was a lot easier back in the day. But that's pretty much my story.
Okay. I appreciate both of y'all's stories. My first question is, tell me how do y'all end up in Jackson, Mississippi? How do y'all end up there? What brought y'all there?
Visiting the government centers, the RNA, Republic of New Africa government centers, going there to, you know, to just to see what was going on with the brothers and sisters, and of course Akima, being first vice president, you know, I'm sure he and Brother Imari and the other officials had, you know, things to talk about, and so we went there to visit, and you know, it ended with you know, being attacked by the police and FBI. Akima, you want to take it from there? Go into more detail?
Well, I'm not sure where we're going, but that's how we ended up in Mississippi. We were also traveling to other places as well, but we part of our travels were to come to the National Territory. And, of course, we had been in the area a little before that during the land celebration, but on that particular trip it was, you know, just to visit with the brothers and to connect.
Okay. I have a question, right? Y'all mentioned the consulate earlier. During that time, were all the consulates nationwide, what is a proponent in regard to the self-defense and self-determination aspect, and were that mandatory, or what were the situation in regard to that, in regard to the military and the self-defense aspect and different consulates and different cadres? Was that something mandatory at that time, or what were actually going on?
If I understand the question correctly, we were to organize wherever we were in the national territories. You know, those were, you know, government centers and building for nation building and ultimately for a plebiscite. But outside of the territory, we were to organize and educate and prepare people, brothers and sisters, for the programs and initiatives. And many, I shouldn't say many, but several brothers and sisters from our consulate actually moved to Mississippi. And so from around the country, whatever sales we organized or government centers to support the overall efforts, many would move to the South, in particular Jackson and Bolton and maybe other areas as well. But in terms of anything being mandatory, I would say mandatory in terms of the concepts and being true to what it was that we were building. And certainly security and training in terms of security and protection went along with it. But if I understand you correctly, it was just – and of course, officials from the national government would come to the local areas and participate in education and training. And if I understand you correctly, it was just a matter of protocol in terms of building for self-determination and those elements of nation building that were taught in practice and in unison with other units of the government in whatever location. And, of course, we were spread out from the East Coast to the West Coast, Midwest, the South, and you know, from time to time we would connect based on the need. We had gone out, Chokwe and I, to California. We'd stopped in Denver. You know, it's just an effort to organize and prepare our people wherever they were. And if we were able to, we organized formally in consulates outside of the national territory and government centers inside the national territory. I'm hopeful that I'm answering the question that you're asking.
Yes, sir, Bob. You gave me an excellent response. An excellent response to the question. Now, my next question is, what actually is different between a government center and a consulate? What's the difference?
Well, we considered Milwaukee, you know, not in the national territory. You know,
okay.
But where we were organized in the five state areas, that was, you know, that was our territory. Obviously, it wasn't liberated, but we delineated, you know, the national territory and then, you know, America outside of the national territory.
This question for both of y'all. What does it mean to you individually, each, to be a member of the RNLF? Like, what does that actually mean, you know, from y'all perspective, individually? What does that actually mean, to be a member of the RNLF?
For me, it meant that I was a citizen of a black nation, and it was like very precious. It meant that, you know, I was willing to give my all in all to try to maintain and push forward that Black nation. It meant a whole lot. It was very strong, you know. You couldn't tell us that it wasn't gonna, you know, come to fruition. I mean, in a little while, I really felt like, you know, we were on to something and it was gonna happen. As a matter of fact, I think I had said before, you know, we really believed that we had the slogan, "The land will be free in 73," and we really thought. And really, or some of us really felt that, and we were pushing towards that. And what it meant was that we were going to be free and independent of this United States government.
Okay. Brother, would you repeat the question? Did you say RNA 11 or RNA Nation? Or what did you, when you asked?
Okay, I'll feed it by that, Kim. I said, what does it mean to you individually, to be a member of the RNA 11. What does that mean to you?
Oh, the RNA 11.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you meant being a citizen.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood.
Well, I'll go, though. But, of course, the house where we were attacked, there were seven individuals. You know, five brothers and two sisters. And in the other house, there were four individuals, three brothers and one sister. And all together, we were 11. And so we became RNA 11 because the U.S. government lumped us together under conspiracy charges, under charges of leveling war against the state of Mississippi, treason, and any number of other charges. But we were the 11 because we were lumped together, even though the shootout only occurred at one house. The other four were, both houses were surrounded and were to be vamped on. Luckily, the house where Brother Mari was at the government center, someone was up, and when the police surrounded that house, someone simply came out and inquired what this about, and it was de-escalated. The same thing would have happened at the house at 1148 Lewis Street, except that no one was awake. But in similar fashion, no one was wanted for anything at either house. It was a bogus attempt to attack and kill us based on bogus premises. But at 1148 Lewis Street, no one was awake, and so they were able to spring their trap. And, of course, you remember from previous discussions and maybe, you know, footage elsewhere, we were surrounded by FBI and local police, and they say they gave us 75 seconds to come out of the house. And when no one came out, then they began to shoot into the house. They say with tear gas canisters. But when glass is being broken, window shattered, plaster falling from the walls, you know, those are lethal projectiles being tossed into the house. And so, but the question is RNA 11. And what that's meant over the years is that this was a continuation of the attack on our people's movement for self-determination. You know, the Black Panthers, us, any number of organizations and groups were targeted by COINTELPRO under leadership of the FBI, and we were just a part of that. And So after the shootout, of course, there continued to be a movement around our defense. And when Mama Tamu got out, she was very active in raising awareness about our plight. And so we have continued to be in the RNA 11. Those that are still left, there are maybe five or six of us still left. You know, some of us have gone on to, you know, have transitioned. But it's meant historically a symbol of resistance, and for at least Tamu and myself, a symbol of familyhood in the midst of an assault on our very lives, but an assault on our dignity and our right to self-determination as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. You want to add on to that moment, Tom?
Well, he pretty much just said it all, so I kind of bummed it the first time.
That's all good. It's all good. You know, okay, my next question here, right? Do y'all consider the 1140 Lewis Street incident attack as a victory for the New African Nation? What are y'all
as
thoughts
a what?
On that?
As a what?
As a victory. As a victory.
Victory.
As a win.
Oh, okay. Tomo, you want to answer that?
Well, you're asking how do we see, or do we see it as a victory?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, in the sense that we were not hurt. They came there to annihilate us. And, you know, we survived. And I'm sure they never anticipated us walking the street as, quote, unquote, free men and women. And we've been able to do that. And, you know, many of us were able to, you know, have families, raise families, and you know, continue to fight and struggle for independence and to live our lives. So, yes, I do consider that a victory. First and foremost is because we have our lives. They could have taken our lives any time that they wanted to once we were arrested. And so it's really, you know, a victory. And I'm sure that there were certain restraints that they didn't take our lives once we were arrested, because if the incident made national and international news, so it was kind of, you know, if they had taken our lives at that point, you know, there would have been, you know, a lot more discussion and so forth. But so that would, I consider that as being restraint, the fact that the whole world, well, several, you know, it was that we were being looked at internationally and nationally. So that helped us a lot as well. So, but yeah, definitely a victory.
Yeah, I concur. the fact that a wood frame house in the black community in Jackson, Mississippi was riddled with bullets. I was mentioning in a conversation that Tamu and I had very recently, last week, I had bought a brand new Volvo and parked in the driveway, and that car was riddled with bullets, as the house was. And yeah, it was a victory in many ways, because the brothers and sisters who were permanently here in there in Jackson had prepared us for an eventual attack, not knowing where it would come from. And it was said that the gun battle lasted for 20 minutes. I'm not sure that it lasted that long, but certainly much of the time that house was being riddled with bullets, the seven of us were underneath the house. And we kind of chuckle about it. After we came out of the house, they continued to fire into the house because the police and the FBI had, they couldn't fathom that that no one of us was wounded or killed and still in the house. And but the victory continued because even though many of us were found guilty and sentenced to time, the attorneys did a magnificent job in keeping us out of the death penalty, away from the death penalty. You know, just consider in 1971, primarily youth, quote-unquote militant youth from the North, as they depicted us, coming to Mississippi talking about taking over, and then there being a situation where three white officers were wounded, one fatally wounded, and then youth going on to trial and ducking or escaping the electric chair. That you wouldn't think so if you just think back logically. 1971, white police officer killed, 25-year-old, 26-year-old militant black being accused, you would think that that's automatically a death penalty situation. And the threat was there, but the attorneys were expert in preparing the jury for a situation where they decided not to take our lives. And then, of course, prison and the fact that we were able to raise a family. Not all of the RNA 11 were so fortunate, but anyway, yes, it's a victory for our people as well. It's one of those rare situations where we're not talking about them slaughtering us. We're able to reflect on it, where we stood our ground and didn't come out totally on the losing end. And certainly it's not anything that we're proud of, to be involved in a deadly shootout. And, of course, when we reflect, the PGRNA was involved in another situation in Detroit where, you know, we were fortunate enough to come out of the situation with the injuries being on the other side. But certainly for our movement and for the RNA and for our people's movement globally, I count it a victory. And it's a victory, too, because of you and other young people who carry on the struggle and who keep the fact of our right to self-determination alive and well. And while we're not where we want to be, the fact that we're continuing to chip away is a sign of victory, because as a movement, we were not deterred, so we continue. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Bob. I appreciate your words of upliftment. You're right. We are still here and still pushing. Yeah. I have one more question, then I'm passing on to Mr. Oscar Cayley. This is geared to a moment of time. I know you previously have wrote a book called Tardy Cointerpro for 1148 Lewis Street, right?
Right.
What has prepared you to write the book after all these years? You know, cause it took a while. It mustered up the thought to do it. So what made you write it all of a sudden?
Pretty much the community helped me, because it's always been in my heart to write, but life happens. You know, you're busy living, and you just, you know, kind of, it's just like on a back burner. And, you know, you just kept it on the, I kept it on the back burner. But we talked, as we moved on, and people would hear bits and pieces about our story, and, you know, they were encouraging me to write. You know, I had spoken a couple times, mentioned that I was planning to write a book, and people kind of pushed me, nudged me on. And finally, after retiring from my regular day job, I finally, you know, decided to go ahead and write. So I did. Once I got started, that was it. You know, it didn't take long, but yeah, it's all, I've always, from the beginning, when the shootout first happened, and I always tell the story that when our parents had come down for one of the trials, and I just casually mentioned that I said, someday I'm going to write about this. And one of the parents, who's deceased now, said, when you write, you should title your book 1148 Lewis Street. And I never forgot that. And that was back in 72 or more. And so I never forgot it. It's always been in my heart and in my mind that I would write. And I'm thankful that, you know, I was still here, stayed here long enough to write.
Okay, I appreciate that. If an individual wants to obtain your book, how would they go about obtaining it?
Well, there's three ways to get my book, and that is to, you could get it from usliftingus.com and click on the store. And Us Lifting Us is an economic effort that we're doing now. Hakeena might want to mention a little bit more about that. But anyway, you can get it from there, from our store. And you can also get it from Amazon, and you can get it directly from me. And I could, you know, by giving you my number.
Okay. I appreciate that. I have one more thing. I want to apologize to Bob and Kima for, I remember you told me previously before a couple of times that day you're born, it just slipped my mind. User memory type of thing, right? So I want to apologize for that. And say happy birthday.
That's quite all right. That's quite all right. I don't want you to miss my 90th and maybe my 100th, but this
okay.
One is okay.
Okay. I got you. I appreciate you, Bob. You know, I appreciate y'all coming on, you know, taking out of understanding. At this time, we're on Pastor Minister Ock McKaylee. You can take a further to the show.
Free land. Greetings and free the land, Mama Temu and Baba Hakeema.
I am
Akin Michele, Minister of Interior for the PGRMA. And I as well just want to thank you all for all of your work and dedication that you have shown towards the RNA as well as the New African Independence Movement.
Thank you.
You were talking earlier about your time in college and how it was a presentation by Dr. Amari that everyone, about 100 people signed up to be with the PGRNA on that particular speaking or whatnot. Can you both expound on that and give some insight as to what Dr. Meyer could have possibly said that basically pivoted, you know, because I'm pretty sure you all didn't go or your mind. Well, I don't know. Maybe you did have that thought process, but to experience something like Dr. Mari's speech and then to, you know, set your life towards the New African Independence Movement, were you already headed that that way, or did the speech kind of sway you that way? Can you expound on it? Did that make sense? I mean, am I?
Yeah, I think I understand the question. I quite frankly don't remember that much about the speech. But I kind of know what would have moved me. Of course, the event, Dr. James Turner, who I think was the head of the Black Studies Department or a professor at Cornell, around the country, we were in the heat of activities on particularly white campuses to bring Black Studies programs and Black Studies Department into being. And so this was a national conference of brothers and sisters who were involved in the Black Studies movement. And I think what would have moved me and is the utterance of a clear prescription that spoke to our desire to have self-determination. I mean, it's one thing to have a Black Studies Department, and so you study and you commune with your brothers and sisters and reflect on history and have some notion of the future. But in that setting, you're not getting clear instructions or prescriptions in terms of what one would do, families would do, the community would do in order to actually advance your desire for self-determination and sovereignty. So for me, it would have been that here was a clear analysis of historically who we've been, who we are now, and what it is that could happen in the future that would put us in a situation where we would have greater control. And of course, the portion that Brother Bomani read earlier in terms of the rights of a free people. I have never considered myself anything other than a free person. This whole notion of American citizenship, I may have found a way to bring it out of my mouth, but in my spirit, I've always known that I had an existence beyond these confines. And so I would imagine that Brother Imari spoke to me in terms of touching what was latent in me in terms of a desire to be, in fact, free, not just imagining my freedom. And I would imagine it touched it in the hearts and the minds of others, because there was a good number of us who, in fact, pledged allegiance to the provisional government at that event. Tomo, you may want to say, you know, something further.
Did you understand my question, Mama Tomo?
Yeah, I think that the thing that got me was the idea, the very idea of Black people being in charge of themselves, for having our own government. That idea was just so fundamental. And as I said earlier, these ideas were new to me, and it just kind of blew me away. I was just totally for that. It was just the most precious thing that I had ever heard, of us being able actually, you know, working toward our own governing and our own being in charge of ourselves, and not have to be subject to this system. You know, I knew it would not happen overnight, but it was just something that as I said, it was just the most precious words that I had ever heard. And then Brother Mari was very, very passionate about it, and it seemed like he knew what he was talking about, and he sounds so profound, and like, we can do this, and I believed that we could do this. He made it sound so real, and man, it was like nothing else mattered at that point. You know, this is what's got to happen. This is it, to be able to move on, you know, as free people, away from this government. So that's pretty much what cooked me. It's just the very idea.
All right. Thank you for that. And the reason for that particular question was because, as my position as a Ministry of Interior, it is my duty to get the word out about the RNA. And so hearing, you know, those types of that type of information is crucial for me to help figure out how to propagate effectively. And it looks as if going into our secondary higher education schools would be a good tactic to try again. So I've been trying to come up with different ways to address that. And I just want to thank you all for giving me that feedback. Let me spin it a little bit. Do you feel that, you know, just showing up and being in that particular setting in 2023, as opposed to, you know, when you all were in college, what do you think may be some of the challenges that would need to be overcome now in this day and age, as opposed to back then, with trying to convey that same sense of understanding of, you know, we can do this into people?
And if I understand you correctly, I would say that our people are ready for the message, but I think we've got to also demonstrate success. Much of our efforts have to be actually in building, nation building, from the ground up. Some levels of proficiency in terms of being able to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, house ourselves. In other words, to build a nation, starting with the family and the community. And so part of what we will say and must say is to project in terms of what can be accomplished, but it's also important to show what has been accomplished and to point to those on-the-ground efforts where we have, in fact, brought together families and institutions and welded them together in a community of brothers and sisters who are building together towards the ultimate solution. So it's show and tell. I mean, we got to point to some things that we're actually doing as we also point to what it is greater that we can do. That would be my answer.
And I do think that there are different kinds of challenges now than it was then. There's some pros and some cons. You've got a lot more, I think, at this point. You do have a lot more integration kind of things and that's happening, but you also have a lot of brothers and sisters who are aware and have studied. You have a lot of people who are studying more now, And there's a lot more information out there now that's inspiring people to want to do for self. So you got it on, I think, on both sides. You got, you know, a lot of people, like I said, a lot more things pulling at people on the other side, you know, integration is this kind of thing. But at the same time, you got so much more information out here that's inspiring our people to want more. And there's a lot of people who are feeling it but have not been exposed. So the more people are exposed, there's a different way of doing things. I think that's definitely a plus on our side to get us motivated to want to move in the direction of self-determination.
All right, thank you. Thank you both. I appreciate your thoughts on that.
Ashe.
And at this time, I'm going to pass it back to Brother Bomani to see if we have any callers on the line that have any questions. Brother Bomani, if you would.
Okay. Freeland, Conrad, I appreciate that. At this time, I'm opening the line up for the callers. If you have any question, comment, or statement, please press 1. Open your line up. Okay. If any of the callers have any question, comment, or statement, please press 1 and open your line up at this time. Anyone have any question, comment, or statement at this time, please press 1. I'll open your line up. I don't see no question at this time, so I'm going to ask a question.
Okay.
I'm going to ask a question. First, I'm just saying I'm enjoying this dialogue. I'm enjoying this conversation. It's a beautiful conversation. But this is all I want to ask. Based on being in that traumatic situation, right, encourage y'all to continue to go on to be active in New African Independent Movement, to still want to be citizen. What encourage y'all to do so? What would the motivating factor behind that?
It's what's in us. I think I speak for both of us, and of course Tom was going to speak to that. But that's who we are. Our spirit, our desire, everything about us speaks to building our movement for self-determination and ultimately for sovereignty or nationhood. And so we continued to build even behind the walls. And, of course, Mama Tamu got out in 10 months, and she actively was involved with others in helping us who were inside, but not only the RNA 11, but other political prisoners and other movements as well. And when I was able to come home to my family after 9 years, and of course I got out based on a technicality, but when I got out, I had been in conversation and writing back and forward to brothers and sisters outside of the walls, and I was prepared to get back into the movement in an organized way. And in fact, I did. When I got out, I came to Milwaukee to join my family, and we only stayed there for a year, and then we moved to Atlanta. But we started organizing in Milwaukee, and then when we got to Georgia, we continued to organize. Because it's more than a thing to do, is who we are. And so the motivation came from a core belief that that as a self-identified nation, not only did we have the rights, but we had the obligation to continue to build. And that building must continue even after a liberation, because you still got to build it to maintain it, to strengthen it, and to pass it to future generations. So the motivation for me came from the essence of who I'd become as a young adult.
And I think the same thing is pretty much true, because wherever I find myself, I am who I am. And that's how I present myself, and that's what my goal and objective is, to try, is to just be me, and it encourages other people. And it's almost like, you know, just be, as we used to say in RNA, being that light. Whether I'm in school teaching, if I'm at a church, if I'm at a ball game, wherever I am, you know, it comes out. And when you become that person or that entity, that's just who you are, and you exhibit that wherever you are, wherever you find yourself.
That's right. Sure.
I appreciate the response, and I appreciate the articulation of it. And the determination and the commitment goes a long way, and y'all shoot now for that. Decades plus, 50 plus years of dedication, determination, and commitment. You know, that truly inspires. For anybody who is listening now or listening in the future to the broadcast, they should be motivated by that. In regard to that determination, and also seeing that you still can build a family and build a nation in the midst of all the chaos. You know, and at this time, he got another question. I asked a question, open a line for a caller. Got a question as well, but I'm going to let Akin Michaela ask here first, then I'll open a line up for the caller. Thank you.
Free the land. One more question I wanted to add. In the self-determination that you all had, how key of a role do you both feel that family played a part in that? Because, you know, as yourselves individually, you are who you are, but how do you all feel that family played a role in that?
You
want to
answer that first? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Family does help a lot, because when you're working together and you're on the same team, you know, that strengthens you. And as I always say, the community and the idea, the things that we were working with also strengthen our family. So it works both ways. You know, some people ask about the longevity of our relationship. And, you know, part of that is the things that we worked on together, or at least had the same mind on, which undergirded our relationship. And likewise, our relationship was helped to strengthen, I think, our efforts in what we were doing. Because, I mean, because, you know, you don't have anybody pulling against what you're doing, in other words. You know, you've got somebody who's supporting your ideologies and the things that you're working with.
Ashe. And I'll just continue that and say that, you know, family is fundamental. As a matter of fact, before we became a couple under what we would call black law marriage at that time, we actually got permission from our families to build a life together. And it was only after some time after I was incarcerated did we decide to marry formally under U.S. law, just to make things more easier to navigate. But again, as the family know, you know, we built family, or conceived our three daughters while we were still incarcerated, while I was incarcerated. And so family has been central. One of the things that I'm proud of that I don't talk about it often enough, but our three daughters made a decision to stay close to us. One of my daughters lives in the neighborhood in the subdivision that we live, and the other two daughters are stone's throw away. So, and the grandchildren are not that far as well. So, for us, family is fundamental. It's central, and it's a matter of what gives me strength. And I know what gives Tamu strength, the fact that our children are supportive and in their own way are still a part of the movement. All three of them are engaged day-to-day in some aspect of advancing our people's interests. And so that's heartwarming when you reflect on it. A lot of times families are separated and people will flare off and go in other directions away from a community building. But that has not been the case with our family. So family is fundamental. We build a nation for the family, you know, and for the members of the family.
I say. Thank you both. I appreciate your thoughts. And I just want to again say thank you for all the contributions that you provided for those coming behind you to continue on the struggle. I yield to my co-host, Brother Beaumont.
Okay. I appreciate it, Mr. Akin McKaylee. At this time, I'll open up a line, 901-480. The line is open for any question coming to statement. Please do so at the time. 901-480. The line is open for any question coming to statement.
Free the land. How y'all doing tonight?
Yes,
peace and free the land. Baba and Mama, how y'all doing?
Doing good.
I am Sister Melly Queen. I'm Deputy Minister of Information and Secretary of the PCC of the PGRNA. And that was one of my questions I was going to ask you all. Were your daughters still in the movement? And y'all just answered that. And I wanted to ask this question. You know, with all these distractions and things that we have going on nowadays, right, how are we going to pull our children back? Because I have teenage children, you know, and adult, you know, young adult, but they not, you know, into what I'm into right now. And I just got into it myself, you know, I haven't been here, you know, all my life, but I, you know, I'm learning now. So how do we get our children to, you know, come this way? And I yield.
You want to start, Tomo?
You know, like I was saying earlier, you know, you have to just live the life and try and encourage. I don't think you can force anything on people, but live the life, be that light, you know, wherever you are, if you've accepted that role that, you know, you've accepted, you know, self-determination, and that's what you, just be that, just live it wherever you are. And that's all pretty much in terms of young people and trying to teach as you go. And again, you just have to live that life, and people see it, and they'll either come to it, as they say, build it, and they'll come. So, you know, I don't know that there's any magic way to make people, or young people particularly, you just have to live it. And if they see it, I think a lot of them will be encouraged and will come. But I don't really know. I don't really have an answer for that.
Well, I would say that I would say that the more examples that our young people can see in terms of community building, nation building, things that we actually do that make a difference, if it's childhood education, if it's elder care, if it's agriculture, if it's building, you know, disaster preparedness, emergency training, whatever it is that we do on a consistent basis, we were lucky enough to be able to invite our children and grandchildren to actually participate in the projects that we were involved in. And they got a sense of pride from day-to-day personal involvement. And so to the extent that you can work with citizens and other brothers and sisters in the community around, you know, tangible projects. I know in Atlanta, some of them are built around urban agriculture. They may be around healing. But sometimes it's not enough to say what should be done. We've got to be in a position where we can demonstrate and people see the benefits of what it is that we are building. But thank you for the question.
I say, thank you both, okay? Thank y'all so very much. I say, and I yield.
Where you at, sister? What city you calling from?
I'm calling from Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
I'm in Ida B. Wells District. Yes, sir.
All right. Great.
You got anything else to say, Crystal Metal Queen?
Yeah, that's it. Thank y'all. Y'all have a great night. It's been an awesome show. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
Appreciate you too, sister. If anyone have any question, comment or state and please press one at a time. I open your line up. Anybody got any question, comment or statement, please press one to open your line up at this time. Please press one. Okay. In the meantime, okay, I got another caller. 864-436. Your line is open. You got any questions, comments, please, this is your time. 864-436. Your line is open. Go ahead.
Free the land. It's Taju. And I just wanted to say thank you to Baba Hakima and Mama Tamu for their strength and their courage. Like, I felt really inspired. And your character and sticking with it and sticking with your people, even through adversity, overcoming it. It's a good example for all of us. So I just wanted to say thank you. And thank you for the show, to the brothers. Thank you for the show, hosting the show.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sister. Do you have anything you got to tell sister? Hey, you, or that's it?
That's all.
Okay. We appreciate that. Okay. Still at this time, the line is still, you're still, if you got a question, comment, statement at this time, please press one. Yeah, any question, comment, statement, please press one. My question is, what exactly is uplifting us, and what is the significance of having an economic base when it comes to nation building? That's my question.
Thank you for the question. Uplifting us, and I would encourage everyone in the audience, the host as well, to visit usliftingus.com. USliftingus.com. And when you get there, you're going to be confronted with an opportunity to play a short 3-minute video. And the name of the video is A Serious Question for You. And it pretty much answers what Us Lifting Us is about. And essentially, it's a formula for how you build a black economy. It involves three overarching elements. The first one is a way to aggregate resources, knowledge, labor, and finance capital. The second element is how to use the aggregated resources to build a network of group-owned, community-owned businesses and enterprises. And the third element is a way to distribute the benefits so that it strengthens the community. And you just repeat that. And through repeating that, what you do is you begin to gain greater attraction in the community, and you introduce to the community group-owned, community-owned enterprises in the overall economic landscape. But the more of those you have in place, then the environment begins to change because unlike the current business climate where the successful businesses and the successful owners may take their resources to other countries, take their resources to other communities. When the businesses are owned by the community, there's no place for them to reside other than the community. So what we are building is a process that forces the circulation and the retention of benefits of business activities to stay in the community and to grow the community. And, of course, economics is not everything. But if you don't have an economic floor, there's very little that you can build. So we see economic empowerment and the control of the economy of our neighborhoods as the foundational floor. So Us Lifting Us is involved in building and maintaining an economic empowerment infrastructure for the nation.
Okay. I appreciate that, Baba.
Ashe.
Okay, I appreciate that, Baba. You know, in regards to that, right, in regards to Ujamaa Cooperative Economics, right, in your experience and your work, what are some of the issues you have faced and how did you solve those issues in regards to doing the work? What were the results?
I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, you learn so many lessons, and of course, you learn from mistakes as well, more times than you learn from successes, I guess. But I think overall, the thing that I would want to share with the family is that be committed long-term to building the systems and institutions that become the tools of empowerment. A lot of times we think that I am, my body, my mind, my spirit is the tool. Yes, it's the tool, but we must then, from a sovereign intellect, or a mindset of independence and do for self, we first must concentrate on building the systems and institutions that do the heavy lifting. And I think that's primarily the thing that I've learned, that what we haven't done to the extent that we must do is to concentrate on building the institutions to do the heavy lifting and not think that me as a brother or Mama Tamu as a sister, that we got to do the heavy lifting. You know, the human is a tool, using a tool, creating, you know, animal, so to speak. And what we maybe haven't done, I shouldn't say maybe, what we for sure have not done, we have not been as sophisticated as we need to be in terms of building systems. So that's the lessons that I've learned and that I think we have learned overall. And the truth of the matter is, until we get good at building systems and institutions at the base of community, we're not going to have a lot of success, because the forces that we look at that are in opposition to our welfare, it's not the individuals that are the force that dominate and exploit us. It's the force of their institutions. And so we must build concomitant, powerful institutions to go against their institutions. And so one of our persons that we're learning from, and y'all may want to Google this person, and I'm not prepared to spell his name, Azra Aharon, who's a professor at Delaware State University. His recent book, The Sovereign Psyche, he suggests that we as African people in the world are deficient in sovereign intellect. And what he means by that is that once you make the decision to be a sovereign, that you're going to rule self, then the thing that you have to do for the primary thing that you have to do is build institutions, systems and institutions that facilitate and aid you in doing that work. And so Brother Aharon suggests that a brother or sister who has reached a level sufficient of a sovereign intellect or a sovereign intelligence, the only things that they really do, the primary thing they do, is spend their time building systems and institutions. I'll just say it this way, and maybe I'll be better understood. It's said that Henry Ford invented the automobile. That may or may not be the case. But certainly during the time that the automobile was invented, there were thousands of people worldwide involved in attempting to bring about the creation of an automobile. The world knew that the time of the horse and buggy had passed, and so it was time to bring in this new machinery. But if Henry Ford was the inventor of the automobile that he's given credit to, the greatest success was the fact that he didn't just set out to build another automobile. He set out to build an assembly line so that the technology existed to build thousands of automobiles. So what we must is building assembly lines, not assembly lines to build automobiles, but the technology of building African-centered communities, institutions in those communities that speak to our needs. So that, I guess, to bring it to a head, I've learned that, you know, movements that are devoid of institutions don't last. The institutions last. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Appreciate it, Baba. Hey, Kima. I have another question, right? Let's get out of word. Hold on. I just lost my train of thought. Hold up.
Tamu, did you want to elaborate on the lessons learned?
Yeah, not really.
Do.
Okay.
Okay. Well, my question is, Why is it important to support New African political prisoners, New African POWs, and catch New African citizens? Why is it so important to do so? And what are some of the ways people you can support from your own experiences?
For one thing, keeping their names out there and keeping information about them, how they're doing and all that, making sure that the institutions know that they've got people out here looking at them. That helps to protect them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's so important. When you're on the inside, you know that you got an extended family of support out there. It makes a world of difference. The prison guards know it. The prison administration know it. And when you receive those letters and other gifts, I remember us, you know, receiving moon pies and any number of goodies, you know, from the outside. It meant a lot, you know. I don't want us to get stuck on moon pies, but that's one of the tangible things that we received. And you know, and but you were about to say something else, Tomo.
I don't know, those who have read my book, I was in a situation where, you know, I could have really been harmed, but they knew that, well, I used the fact that they didn't know anything about who the Republic of New Africa may have been, who was on the outside, but they knew that we had that support from New African Brothers and Sisters, and I think that it served it for protection for me in one incident.
Mama Tom, you talking about the part in your book where you was where you actually in the cell and what that happened? I try to remember the part you're talking about in your book.
When the brother threatened me?
Yeah, the brother threatened you. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a very clear incident where, you know, I knew that my bluff and my mentioning, and I didn't call a name or anything of who they need to look out for, but it was very clear that they knew that somebody was looking at us, and that if they heard about if he carried out his thoughts, that he would have been dealt with righteously.
Yes, ma'am. That's a good thought. You know, you have something to say, Bob Hakim?
No.
Okay. I know when the Arnold Levin situation happened, right, shortly after they assassinated Conrad George Jackson, years later in 79, they created the Black August War, they created Black August Resistance, right? And now within Black August Resistance, the acts that y'all perform regularly at the Arnold Levin is part of Black August Resistance, right?
Yes.
My question here to y'all, what does Black August Resistance, or what does resistance in general, mean to y'all?
You want to go first, Tomo?
No, you go first.
Well, Mama Tamu and I were guests at an event last Wednesday or Thursday, I'm not sure, the 17th, Marcus Garvey's birthday. And was a part of Black August, and we generally are involved in several events around August, Black August. And it for us, or at least for me, it's a time of the year, or a permanent feature of our global struggle to recognize, you know, those efforts that we can pin to August. And, of course, many of them have influences, obviously, beyond August and for life, because certainly celebrating Marcus Garvey's birth in August. And, of course, like we said a little earlier, my birthday as well and my daughter's birthday. But it's refreshing to know that our community keeps certain principles alive and through rituals move them forward. It gives us strength even when we may be confused or not totally comfortable or confident in the next move that we might make. But certainly it points to the fact that there is something alive in us, something stirring in us, and that keeps us looking towards greater achievements. And certainly Black August is that. But more than any other time, it points to the brothers and sisters who may have been at the forefront of confronting, you know, the forces in opposition to our welfare. And for those brothers who and sisters who may have lost their lives or may have died behind the walls, and those that are still alive behind the walls, and those that have been released but still impacted by the attacks, it's refreshing to know that there is a community that is alive and still seeking to develop ways of continuing to struggle and to break through to a better days. Thank you.
Yeah, to me, it's a time to remember and to face things that you may because of your daily living and daily struggles, but this is a time when you're forced to face it and look at our history and keeping it alive and just remembering the and in some ways celebrating who we are. It's just another opportunity to do that.
Ashe.
I appreciate the response, you know. I appreciate the response. Yeah, I'm going to see if Minister Aki got another question. If not, we can get to the final thoughts. But Minister Aki, you have another question?
No, brother, I'm good right now.
Okay. I also would like to let it be known that today, commemorate the assassination of Comrade George Jackson, which is August 21st, 1971. It's also commemorate the rebellion of Nat Turner, 1831. It also commemorate the start of the Haitian Revolution in 1797, you know, it started the Haitian Revolution. So this is a very, well, Bob Hakeem's birthday today. So, you know, this is a very significant day, in time of resistance, a time in regard to we spread self-determination, a time in which we present the aspect that we want to be free and land independent, the time that we actually are defending ourselves and show the self-determination on all levels and aspects. And this is a month that is hot and full of passion and desire that is needed for us to push forward and continue to be dedicated, determined, dependent, and committed, which is exemplified by Bob Hakeem Mama Tamu, long relationship, and a long-time commitment to the New African Independent Movement. That's what it shows. You know what I'm saying? That's what's going on. And again, I want to thank them for coming to the platform to share another one to stand on. Thank you for their sacrifice and the work they continue to do and continue to be inspiring to the people. And at this time, I would like to have y'all final thoughts. We can end the show after y'all final thoughts.
My final thoughts is that I certainly appreciate what you all are doing. I appreciate that and keeping the movement alive and hanging in there.
Yeah, ditto. I concur and congratulate the family, and you know, rejoice in the struggle. It's a blessing to be able to give energy to our growth, to our development, and ultimately to our victory. I just want to say, in a sober sense, if all opposition to our rise miraculously left the planet tomorrow, it was gone, the struggle would continue, because we have to meet our needs. We have to build. We have to deal with the elements. And so just consider the, quote-unquote, the oppressors as part of the environment. And so just know that irrespective of the day, the month, the year, we have to be in a posture of nation building every day and every minute of the day, and family building as well. So thank you, brothers and sisters, and stay strong and stay positive, and we look forward to joining with you another time for your show.
Yes, sir. The pleasure is all ours, Santa Santa. Minister Akin, what are your final thoughts, brother?
For the land, I just want to again thank you both, Mama Temu and Baba Hakima, for being a shining example of what it looks like to dedicate your life to the struggle. And I appreciate all of your kind words and your wisdom. And I just hope that I am able to be half as dedicated as you all are throughout my lifetime. And I appreciate it. And I look forward to being able to do some work with you all in the future.
I appreciate it. You know, again, I'd like to thank a moment talking about Hakima. Thank you, all the listeners. Thank all the callers for anybody having a question. If anyone is interested in learning more about the Visionary Republic of Africa, we have a social media page on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, New Republic of Africa. We also have a website, www.pg-rd.com. Before I go on the website, please create an account and sign in and enjoy the content and the information on it. You know, I want to say long live the position, long live the African independent movement. We are all our Catholic African political prisoners, our Catholic African citizens, Catholic POWs, and just continue to do the work in your environment, make it possible. Do the work, and regardless of what might say or do, be the best version of yourself. And manifest the aspect of free the land. Peace. 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 Peace.